Kia ora and welcome to another podcast in the intriguing series People, Places and the Climate Crisis, a series where I have the privilege of interviewing 16 outstanding climate experts on climate and local government in the lead up to the local body elections in October. I'm Lindsay Wood from the Resilience Climate Trust, and we're running this series in conjunction with Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. At the end of the podcast, I'll give you details of other ways you can listen if you wish. But now it's time for this interview with Simon Miller, the Executive Director of the green business media organisation Pure Advantage. Simon continues on the theme regenerating nature, and he's the second of our guests on this. So here is the conversation with Simon Miller and me, which of course I hope that you enjoy. One of the many pleasures of hosting this series is getting to know more about someone you already had a connection with. And today's guest, Simon Miller, Executive Director of the important green business media organisation Pure Advantage, is one such person. Simon and I have worked together intermittently for several years, yet I've only now discovered just how strong his environmental background really is, ranging from advanced environmental qualifications to sustainable leadership in the US corporate sector, and over the last 8 years, to spearheading the impressive evolution of Pure Advantage itself. Simon, I also learned you have a substantive background in film and TV production in Hollywood, and that's no mean feat, and that might also in part explain why you made such an outstanding success of Pure Advantage's approach to producing all sorts of campaigns, such as Financing the Future 2018 on Impact Investment, or Our Regenerative Future 2020 on Regenerative Agriculture, and more recently on the comprehensive Otato Ngāhari series on the many benefits of native forests. And I think they're just about to take off, aren't they? In which case, you're welcome to give them a plug. Tēnā koe, Simon, a big welcome to People, Places and the Climate Crisis, and thanks so much for contributing to our theme, Regenerating Nature.
Tēnā koe, Lindsay. It's great to connect with you again, and I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Simon, there are increasing examples around the world of different sectors hijacking altruistic terms for their own end. And I think Pure Advantage's stunning series, Our Regenerative Future, gives you some authority to frame for listeners what the term regenerating nature could be taken as meaning, and hopefully also to outline its potential benefits for tackling climate change.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, look, I'm someone who was able to bring together an array of authorities in the form of practitioners and experts, and really help them synthesize and communicate the message. So more of a producer and advocate rather than an authority. But in essence, you know, regeneration in the ecological sense is really about working more closely with nature. So it's actually a huge opportunity and an advantage. And for being more technical, I suppose, you know, regeneration also encapsulates the renewal, restoration and revitalization of our natural systems to ensure we live within our natural planetary boundaries. As well, our regenerative future was also about timing. The initial impact of COVID and the sort of the drastic social and economic changes wrought by that were an opportunity for us to all rethink and try and get the balance right and pursue a regenerative future grounded in deeper connections between people, food, and the land.
Right.
So, I mean, how that sort of came about, and I'll just touch on it real briefly, is that we had been looking at soil carbon sequestration a couple of years before that, and realized that was a very long-term, expensive approach, but also with a lot of people already in train on that. So we sort of pulled back the lens and widened that around sort of ecological restoration and what role soil carbon would have in that. And the best frame for that was Regen Ag.
Right. And that's great because that shoots it into the whole issue of the climate crisis, doesn't it? And soil carbon is part of that whole equation.
Yeah, and you know, like people talk about, you know, synthetic foods or actually I don't like the word synthetic, but in vitro farming, you know, is definitely something that has huge potential and or is happening. and they may, and that whole sector may get to net zero, but regenerative agriculture can actually double down on that by drawing down and restoring, you know, and that's the whole point of it. It's actually a double whammy.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Carbon.
No, that's fascinating. Thanks, Simon. Picking up a bit more on that theme, I love the Pure Advantage webcasts. You know, I was working with you on another project at the time they took off, and they really did go wonderfully. I'm blown away by what people are trying and what they're achieving in the regenerative space. However, you'll recall, as we were both at the Agricultural and Climate Conference last year, you'll recall that Regen Ag got very little mention except from the audience and from some overseas speakers. And I've also had a few comments from the farming community along the lines of, well, Regen Ag is very nice, but it's no good for scaling up. Can you please tell us, do they have a point, or is that sort of comment symptomatic of something else?
You know, regenerative agriculture, you know, there's a lot of New Zealand farmers, if not, I would say, most or all New Zealand farmers and landowners, horticulturalists, viticulturalists, they all probably feel like and think and are farming regeneratively in certain contexts.
Good point.
So maybe it's sort of a knee-jerk reaction to sort of the Kiwi thing is like, wait, I'm already doing that. Why are you telling me to do it differently? But actually it's not that. It's like it's how can we improve and enhance. Regen Ag coming out of Europe and the continents like Australia and America, North America, where the lands have been hugely depleted by commercial ag with chemicals for many decades longer than we have been farming, is part of the impetus why that's become a thing. You know, so they're talking around improving soil carbon from 0.5, 1% to, you know, maybe 1.5, 2%. We've got soils that are operating well above that, you know, especially in the Waikato and Taranaki and Southland and all that sort of stuff. So if it's just about carbon and soil, then it's a little bit of a misdirect in terms of the overall big picture of regenerative agriculture. You know, there's many leading farmers who are showing, you know, profitable livestock farming with reduced intensity of stocking and fertilizer. They have land in which they can plant trees for agroforestry and all that sort of stuff. You know, Silverfern Farms has taken a big step forward in this way. They're telling the regenerative story, which they're eliciting premiums on that for their products. You know, an ORF or Our Regenerative Future lifted the lid on a burgeoning movement in New Zealand, really. And you saw a boost to the work by the likes of, you know, practitioner experts like Sam Lang, John O'Frew with Quorum Sense, even one of our trustees, Jeff Ross, farmer and entrepreneur on Country Calendar recently. He got slayed by audiences.
But he got a real backlash, didn't he?
Yeah, but it's like, I think it's a little bit of tall poppy and like, oh, wait, do you know, that's not how we do it, or it's a little twee or something, you know. But Jeff's right. He says, you know, New Zealand farming currently faces two key challenges: the need to build premiums for our growers in responding to the world's need to decarbonize. And that's it. And the steps they're taking are trying to achieve both. And they are achieving premiums for their climate positive status and other animal welfare techniques. So this is true. Look at the recent EU New Zealand trade deal. You know,
yeah, right.
The agreement commits EU and New Zealand to effectively implement the Paris Agreement and to work together on climate related matters, including carbon pricing or transition to a low carbon economy. So these are really important strategic advantages that New Zealand, you know, has the opportunity to embrace.
And Jeff Ross, in a way, is leading us in on that path, isn't he? Where I've had a little bit to do with Germany, Simon, over the years, and I sometimes think that in New Zealand we underrate the sensitivity of customer bases like Europe to our agricultural practices. You know, I'd sit down for dinner with somebody or with a group, and within 5 minutes we'd be talking about some New Zealand agricultural practice, and it wasn't me that brought it up.
Yeah, Jeff is just one of the farmers. He's a bit more high profile because he's you know, a successful entrepreneur. but Hamish Bielski in the Balclutha area.
Yes.
Lots of farmers that have. There was an event at Silverfern Farms, had an event yesterday in Christchurch, and business journalist Rod Oram told me they had two sessions for over 100 farmers in each, exploring regenerative farm practices. So there's a significant brand with a significant buy-in from the sector looking to make changes, you know, to their practices.
And not only significant, but expanding, if my information is correct too. Mm-hmm. Before we carry on much further, I've already referred to you as being the executive director of the important green business media organisation, Pure Advantage. But even though that means something to me, it might not mean a great deal to some of the listeners. Could you just expand a bit on Pure Advantage and where it sits in all the processes we're going to be talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, Pure Advantage was first established in 2008 by Philip Mills as the founder, and Sir Stephen Tindall and Rob Morrison and Jeff Ross have been key trustees since that time. And it was initiated under the 100% plan, with the aim of convincing the government that Aotearoa should create an economic strategy based on the low carbon industry, because A, it will be one of the major economic drivers of the 21st century, and New Zealand should be positioned to capitalise on that. It would create brand benefits for New Zealand, exports and tourism if we could live up to our 100% pure New Zealand claim. There will be cost savings in shifting to an energy efficient, energy independent, renewable economy. And perhaps most important of all, being clean and green aligns with our spiritual values of New Zealanders, and we could lead the world in dealing with the rapidly approaching threat of climate change and the biodiversity crisis. But so Pure Advantage, you know, wants New Zealand to focus on our natural advantages as strategic business opportunities. So looking through the lens of climate change, why? Because if we do, it matters more to us disproportionately. In other words, ensuring the clean green brand is authentic as possible, and whether that be tourism or primary industry products. We're a catalyst organisation, really. And you actually mentioned it in one of your pieces that you wrote for us. We're a conduit for green growth. We set out a vision for how New Zealand could be, not how it is. You know, so like my job is aspirational, really. I mean, is our New Zealand Inc. plan good enough? You know, for example, with nature-based solutions, where we focused on that recently. Including Regen Ag, like we've talking about soil carbon, biodiversity, water quality, as well as renewable energy and therefore technology. And these are our advantages to meet the myriad crises that we face. So it's way more than carbon.
Just rolling on a little bit further, we won't be short of things to talk about, I know. You touched before on soil quality, and I know I followed that up at the last Ag and Climate Conference with people like Paul Mudge and so on, who said exactly the same as you did, that New Zealand's got pretty good soil carbon and therefore it's not the easiest thing to build it up a devil of a lot compared with, for example, other places. However, I also recall that Federated Farmers saying soil was now receiving a lot of attention in conventional farming. As we mentioned, the conference last year didn't say much on Regen Ag, but it did say that they were short on soil research. And some Pure Advantage episodes showed what I thought were stunning transformations in soil quality under different cropping and management regimes. Could you speak to the hearts of listeners, please, and to would-be councillors, which is one of the targets of this series, about soil, and what would be the core message you'd like their hearts to register in terms of soil and soil carbon, if you want to go further into that?
Soil is sexy.
Oh, I like it. Soil is sexy. Great
soil
stuff.
Soil is sexy. Look, we've been looking at soil carbon sequestration as a way to increase the drawdown of carbon as well as enhance our working lands. But in starting to look at it, at a project or a campaign, there was quite a bit of work already in train, as you mentioned. And we realised producing anything distinct was going to take a long time and a lot of investment to make a real dent sooner than later. I mean, you've got New Zealand's role in the Global Research Alliance, key scientists like Paul Mudge, Louis Schipper, Dr. Gwen Grillet. But where this grew out of was my attendance in 2017 at the global conference of about 150 participants. We launched the soil carbon sequestration listserv. And since then, the whole field has exploded with new growth and tremendous progress. And in fact, how that came about was Christiana Figueres and Betsy Taylor had been at Paris in 2015 and realized that we needed to look at soils. But in the past 5 years since then, the conversations have really broadened to include water, biodiversity, ecosystem health. And, you know, carbon in organic matter is very mobile. It's particularly in warmer areas, which makes it conversations on soil carbon sequestration difficult. And in dry regions, it increases in soil organic matter, you know, increases more slowly.
And it's
difficult to make a difference in ecosystem health and water availability. But that's the good news, really. And I think that's where it might lead us into the native forest conversation too, because the misdirect is our myopic focus on just carbon. And I realize that's a key criteria for climate change mitigation, but the solution is far more comprehensive.
Great point. Yeah.
Yeah. And so soil or carbon dioxide, you know, they're sort of hot button, you know, phrases that people are running with, but a far more comprehensive solution is one that we're all looking towards.
And early, right at the beginning, you talked about a bit more of a systems approach, and you're now talking about a more holistic view. So I see those as all being a very good point. Carbon is important, but don't be too fixated on it, sort of things. That's what I'm hearing, or you have to do a whole lot of other good stuff at the same time.
Well, carbon's like the common denominator, isn't it? You know, and we should be fixated on it, and we are. Yeah, but the solutions, the opportunities are far wider than carbon. So like a regenerative farm is not all about sequestering more carbon.
No.
So it's about better health of animals. It's starting to reduce your inputs to hopefully zero.
Of fertilizers and things like that.
Yeah, and that sort of stuff. And there's all other sort of solutions, you know, and interweaving native forests into those landscapes so you're getting more of a holistic benefit around reducing sediment, enhancing water quality, improving biodiversity.
You're giving me some good one-liners. Soil is sexy and carbon is the common denominator. I like it. Love it, Simon. Just rolling on a little bit and bearing in mind that we're dealing with a series that interfaces with the local government elections coming up, I'd like you to try and help tie all of this back into the roles of the local councils. For example, the Tasman branch of Federated Farmers, on their webpage, they list their six top priorities. Out of interest, it doesn't include climate, but that's another thing. But one of them is the costs of funding council services. And I recall a recent US article saying that it was easier to get a consent for an oil rig than it was for a kelp farm. If you were elected mayor of a rural council, Mayor Simon, and accepting that food production is still a critical service that we need to sustain, what initiatives would you be promoting and what would you be discouraging in the interests of restoring natural systems while maintaining reasonable levels of food production? There's a meaning of life question for you.
Right. I guess I could try and run for mayor of Southland, you know, with my home province of Tim.
Are you from there originally? Oh, great.
Yeah. No, but you know, there's a great, you know, with the farming community, with the forestry,
huge, with the
opportunity potentially around Tiwai.
Fascinating.
Yeah, great opportunity there. I think, look, you need to play to the strength of the land, and you need to play to the strengths of the communities and the people. That's really what it's all about, isn't it? It depends where you are. But more authorities are taking aim at the climate crisis. So the Queenstown Lakes District Council and Hamilton City Council both adopted climate policies recently.
Very topical.
QLDC, Climate Biodiversity Plan, set out its response to climate change and biodiversity loss over the next 3 years. One of its goals is to reduce their GHG by 44% by 2030, you know.
Can I just dial back? QLDC is Queenstown Lakes District Council?
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. So, but the you know, like one of your other speakers who I really like, James Rennick, he said, you know, shower local government with abundant resources.
You did.
I mean, that's like, that sounds a little scary to me, but how you could kind of mandate that, and that's something that we've talked about as Pure Advantage, that all spend should be through the lens of climate change to meet our emissions reduction targets.
Yes.
So therefore it's kind of mandated across everything. Like, how's this going to impact a just transition? How's it going to impact pollution?
Or our urban planning or whatever.
Yeah, everything. So if we're not, or adaptation, you know, I believe they are doing that. Are they doing it at pace and scale? We've been heavily distracted by the pandemic for the last couple of 3 years, but we've also advocated for that COVID spend to have been through the lens of climate change too.
Yes, I'm a bit cynical about how effective that was, but you're right, it was advocated, including by Christiana Figueres, who you referred to a little while ago.
Yeah.
Picking up on that a little bit more, Simon, if we're talking about putting all the decisions through a climate lens, and I agree with you, and I have to say, I'm in an area, Nelson, where they declared a climate emergency 3 years ago, say everything's put through a climate lens, but there's not nearly as much evidence of that as we'd like to think. Does that sort of approach mean that councils and, as a result, citizens should be thinking or accepting of a reprioritizing of their civic spend? Because if you put everything through a lens, the suggestion is that you're going to actually shift the way you see things and therefore where you spend money. Can you comment on that a bit for me?
Look, it didn't take Kiwis long to in the world to forget that, you know, how beautiful it was to be in lockdown and breathe fresh air and look at fish in the Waitemata up to Tamaki Drive and all that sort of stuff, because you know, the first day out of the first lockdown, 300,000 Big Macs were sold, you know, and there was a line, you know, down the road. And, you know, 2 years later, I've seen 40% increases in home prices and boats and batches. Everyone who can afford to is off in Europe right now, you know, like, I don't know. It's just, you know, the conscience of change. In some ways, I think, like, it's great to be I'm happy to be in a democratic land, but sometimes I think with climate change regulation, a bit of Xi Jinping might have to kick in, you know, to like make us do things.
I've thought the same at times, that the democratic process can delay it and
yeah. I mean, look how many consultations we've had to respond to for the current government. It's just it's endless.
Yeah, you know? That's right.
We've been talking about it for decades.
I'd like to try and join a couple of dots over two things you've just said, Simon. One is that you just talked about, you know, as soon as we got off the COVID restrictions, how many Big Macs were sold and so on. And in a way, that tells me one thing about the mindset of our community. But the other, you said, when I challenged you, if you were mayor, what would you do? And one of the things you said was you would play to the strengths of the community. But one of the challenges I see is that if you are the mayor of Southland, for example, the strength of that community, or one of the strengths, is agriculture as usual. And therefore, playing to the strengths, to me, seems to need a bit more, just as it did with the Big Mac syndrome, that somehow we need to encourage a shift from our mainstream business as usual way of doing things, which might be our strengths, but which we need to apply those strengths or redirect them into a new direction somehow. The question is how you would reconcile playing to a community's strengths with the fact that we have to actually be looking to do things a bit differently to what that community might traditionally have been accustomed to.
Part of my family's from a farming background in Southland anyway. And so I know a number of farmers, if not a lot of farmers through by extension, are definitely exploring how to change their practices and farm more regeneratively. There are still some that are highlighted by, you know, eco-advocate activist Jeff Reed, you know, highlights the malpractice or by certain farmers and waterlogged
river flats or wetlands.
Yeah, which is obviously not great and should stop. But I think it's also increasingly looking, it's a confluence of these different events, right? So it's the economic drivers. So you've got, what are the opportunities for premiums? Where is the consumer going? So if that's where the puck's going, we should be skating there. You've got environmental impacts. You've got regulation upon those environmental impacts. And so what we advocate is looking for the opportunities within that rather than retrench. How do we capitalise on that in a positive way? And that's part of the work with Otata Nahiri and our nature-based solutions work. You know, I'll just plug our conference coming up. It's October 27th, 28th at Te Papa in Wellington.
Yep.
Otata Nahiri with Tane's Tree Trust, the forest scientists who have been behind that enormous program of work featuring 40 to 50 Kiwi and international experts. We did a short documentary that's free stream on our site, also on TVNZ Plus, that inspired an episode of Country Calendar number 27 on Cassie's Farm, this podcast webisode. So we're bringing a lot of experts together
Wonderful.
To discuss the opportunities to weave more native forests into our working lands. And so that's the impetus behind that piece of work. And so a place like Southland, I think, has a huge opportunity to enhance that, and farmers need to be rewarded for that, you know, and that's the changes that hopefully are happening through the ETS and through the permanent forest category that we've been consulting on, and you know, so yeah, there's a lot of drivers that are happening this year to hopefully make those changes as we go into this next reporting phase.
Great, I'm sure people listening to this will be interested in following up some of the leads and webinars and things that you've just talked about, Simon. Can you give us just go over your website again where they can get information on that sort of thing?
Yeah, pureadvantage.org.
That's not hard. Well done. That's good. Well, look, unfortunately, we're drawing towards the end of this, even though I could keep chatting to you forever. One of the things that I really enjoy about having people like you on the show, and my listeners are probably bored with me saying this, but I love asking you to give listeners what is your top take-home message in your field. So this is an easy one for you, I hope. At the intersection of climate and regenerating nature and local government, what would be your absolute top take-home message for listeners wanting to factor nature into their voting? And you've already given us soil is sexy, so it needs to be something else.
Look, there's the old adage, you know, vote with your wallet, right?
Yeah.
So where do you want to spend your money and you know, support suppliers and producers and organisations that you believe authentically pursuing a cleaner, greener future, which reflects our brand, you know, the New Zealand brand, New Zealand Inc. brand, and that's part of the evolution of Pure Advantage was to authenticate that very thing, to that if we're going to espouse we're a clean green nation, we better double down on that and focus on that, and that is across, you know, all of our primary industry production and tourism and tech center and everything, you know.
Voting with your wallet is a nice way of saying put your money where your mouth is. Well, kia ora, Simon. It's been wonderful chatting with you. And I just wanted to give a big thank you to you. I'm sure listeners will have enjoyed that too. So tēnā koe and all the best for your projects coming up.
Tēnā koe, Lindsay. Ka kite anō, thank you very much. And one thing for you, I'd love to get an invitation to one of your dinners, because I hear they're exceptional, where you convene a bunch of different experts around a big feast. So not Babette's feast, but Lindsay's feast. So I'd like to do that one day.
Oh, it's a worry. I don't know how you heard about that, Simon. That's a story we'll have to unpick another time. Good on you, my friend. Good on you.
All right.
Well, I find I'm constantly surprised by the depth and breadth of knowledge of all the people we're having on this series. I really got a lot out of that. Now, as always, I will give you listening options for the series People, Places and the Climate Crisis. You can listen to the full interview with each guest on their own podcast, and these are available on Spotify, Apple and on other main platforms, and can be linked from my firm's website, which is at resilience.co.nz, and there you can navigate easily to our podcast page. That will also give you the full schedule for the series, plus background information, as well as information on Fresh FM, broadcasting frequencies, and to podcasts of the radio shows, with most of the interviews condensed to about half their original length. As always, a big thanks to Kahu Sanson-Burnett, who does an ongoing wonderful job with the sound and podcast uploading, and of course a big shout out to you, our listeners. Thank you so much for joining this important discussion. We have many more fascinating experts still coming on the series, and I do hope we enjoy your company for them too, including, next up, Joanna Santa Barbara, who is the chair of the Nelson Tasman Climate Forum, and Joanna is one of two guests who will be speaking on the theme of cohesive societies and a just transition. So this is Lindsay Wood signing off, and as always, kia kaha for the climate.